Want to dive into how technology and Black spirituality intersect? Or confront the challenges new tech is creating? Maybe even catch a vision of hope for the future?
Check out Moral Repair, a Black exploration of tech. A podcast about the innovations that make our world and break our societies.
And how we can all heal just a bit. Available on Spotify, Apple, and wherever you listen to podcasts.
Hey there, a quick favor. We are conducting an audience survey, and we'd be really grateful if you could take just a few minutes and answer some questions in the survey. Please visit survey.prx.org/world to take the survey today. Again, that's survey.prx.org/world. And thank you.
The NATO summit in Washington wraps up with some strong words of warning for Beijing.
China has become a decisive enabler of Russia's war against Ukraine.
I'm Carolyn Beeler.
And I'm Marco Werman. Today, more details on that big NATO meeting. Also, the war in Gaza. A key target for the Israeli military has been underground tunnels.
It's slow, it's systematic. I would say that we've probably destroyed maybe a third, but it's very hard to assess that.
Where Israel's military objectives stand. Plus, African immigrants are bringing new energy to churches in the state of Maine.
Just like that connection of where you came from, you're like, okay, we can pray in the same language.
Plus, the London Symphony Orchestra goes insane in the membrane.
That's all ahead today on The World. This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler.
And I'm Marco Werman. Thank you for joining us today. The Israeli army has presented results of its probe into the October 7th battle at Kibbutz Be'eri near the Gaza border. This is the first detailed investigation of the fighting that took place on that day.
The report both highlights the bravery of the community's security team, as well as the Israeli military's failure to prevent the deadly assault led by Hamas.
It concludes that the Israeli army failed to protect residents of the kibbutz, mainly because the military had never prepared for a large-scale infiltration. Be'eri was the hardest-hit community on October 7th. 101 civilians and 31 security personnel were killed. 30 residents of the kibbutz and two other civilians were taken hostage by Palestinians. 11 of them remain in Gaza. At least 125 homes in the community were damaged or destroyed.
To compile the report, investigators spent hundreds of hours reviewing WhatsApp messages from residents, Israeli and Hamas radio communications, surveillance videos, aerial footage, and interviews with survivors.
Meanwhile, CIA Director William Burns is back in the Middle East again this week. He's meeting with top officials from Egypt, Israel, and Qatar. With him is President Biden's top Middle East advisor, Brett McGurk. They have one goal, to mediate between Hamas and Israel and bring an end to the war in Gaza. And as the world's Shirin Jafari reports, there is some cautious optimism about a possible breakthrough.
We've been here before, many times over the past 9 months. As Gaza burned, American officials traveled to Egypt, Israel, and Qatar to try and put an end to this war. But each time, they returned empty-handed. Khaled El-Gindi directs the program on Palestine and Palestinian-Israeli affairs at the Middle East Institute. He says the presence of the CIA director in Doha is significant.
I think that's intended to show seriousness on the part of the administration. Not that previous ceasefire talks weren't serious, but I think they really would like to finally reach a deal.
Egypt's intelligence chief, Abbas Kamel, joined Burns and McGurk this week. So did Israel's heads of Mossad and Shin Bet. President Biden laid out a plan to end the war back in May.
Everyone who wants peace now must raise their voices and let the leaders know they should take this deal.
The deal Biden put forward is a step-by-step process that includes a temporary ceasefire, prisoner and hostage exchange, and humanitarian assistance in Gaza. What's emerging from Doha this week is a three-step process. David Makovsky is senior fellow at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy. He says in return for releasing Israeli hostages, Hamas wants the number of convicted Palestinian prisoners held in Israel to be freed.
The growing demonstrations of the families has been very effective in Israel. That people say, look, you can always go after Hamas later, but get innocent people out of these horrific tunnels. But the hard right says, Yes, of course we want them out. But at what price? This is like getting Sinwar all over again.
Yahya Sinwar is the leader of Hamas in Gaza and is believed to have masterminded the October 7th attacks. He was released from Israeli prison in 2011 in exchange for captured Israeli soldier Gilad Shalit. Leading up to the talks, Hamas leaders dropped one of their key demands, a permanent ceasefire. Instead, they said they would accept guarantees from the mediators that a pause could lead to a long-term ceasefire. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, meanwhile, over the weekend, poured cold water on Hamas's proposal, saying that the war will continue until all of Israel's objectives are achieved. Khaled El-Gindi of the Middle East Institute says Netanyahu has shown time after time that he's not interested in a peace deal.
The Israeli prime minister has a personal and political interest in avoiding a ceasefire for as long as possible because it will mean the end of his political career, and he could also very much go to jail.
Despite Netanyahu's comments, political scientist Abdul Hadi Al-Ajla says he's hopeful.
I see this time is different. Everybody is tired, and Netanyahu is facing huge pressure from within the Israeli society, but also from Gantz and Gallant.
Benny Gantz recently resigned from Israel's war cabinet, and Yoav Gallant is the defense minister. Al-Ajla, who's also a senior fellow at the Arab Initiative, is from Gaza himself and has family there. That includes his sister, Ayad, who's in Gaza City. She's been getting leaflets and phone calls from the Israeli army telling her to evacuate. She's been displaced before, and this time she told her brother that she's not going anywhere.
She said that even if we die, even if they burned us and they brought us to life again, and they asked us to leave Gaza to the south, we will not leave anymore.
The Israeli army says it has to return to Gaza City because Hamas fighters have regrouped there. As the talks took place this week, Israel continued its bombardment of the Gaza Strip, killing and injuring dozens of people. Al-Ajla and many others are keeping a close eye on the negotiations with the hope that they lead to an end to the war.
What I hope is for now to wake up in the morning and not going through names of dead people on my mobile to see if any of my family is there.
And the families of the Israeli hostages say they want to see their loved ones back home. For the world, I'm Shirin Jafari.
For an Israeli perspective on the war in Gaza, we reached out to Miri Eisen in Haifa. She's a former colonel in the Israel Defense Forces with a background in military intelligence. We spoke earlier, and I asked her to describe the military objectives that Israel has achieved since October.
What the Israeli military have achieved is a systematic, slow destruction of Hamas's military capabilities. This has to do with destroying cache of weapons, the different places where they produce the weapons themselves, and the systematic trying to destroy underground subterranean arena. It's slow, it's systematic. I would say that we've probably destroyed maybe a third, but it's very hard to assess that.
You use the word systematic. However, Israeli soldiers are right now returning to areas that they had previously cleared, apparently because Hamas militants have reappeared, Gaza City for just one example. Does that suggest a problem with Israel's overall military strategy, that they're clearing areas and then having to return?
It has to do with Hamas's preparing this for literally 15 years. They literally have mobility throughout the Gaza Strip underground, that they're literally hundreds of miles of this subterranean arena. And you destroy it almost, I would say, 100 yards at a time. That's why it's slow. That's why it's systematic.
There are different estimates on the numbers of Hamas fighters that have been killed so far. Prime Minister Netanyahu recently put the figure at 15,000. At this point, what do you know about the current capabilities of Hamas?
I would say 15,000 would mean in and around half of that fighting force. Those are the ones that were mainly active and, of course, participated not just in the October 7th attack, but in all of the subsequent fighting that's been going on in the last 9 months.
How was Hamas able to construct these hundreds of miles of concrete tunnels that you're talking about without Israel knowing that was happening? I mean, this has been a question since the beginning of this conflict, but doesn't that suggest a real lapse of intelligence?
This is a harsh, ugly war. One of the reasons, and not the only one, that Israel did not act militarily in the last 15 years inside the Gaza Strip, even though you know they're building the tunnels, is because look at what it is to destroy the tunnels. What did I say? Slow and systematic. It's not pretty. It is hard. There's millions of civilians who live there. There is no easy way around it. So knowing that it's there doesn't mean that you can do something about it other than what we're doing now.
You're saying that the IDF is targeting, of course, Hamas fighters, but there have been significant casualties who are not thought to be Hamas, the almost 5,000 women and almost 8,000 children, according to the UN.
My heart, as a mother, goes out to any uninvolved civilian. Israel never targets the civilians. And I say that the worst part about war is that you're targeting these horrific terrorists, and those terrorists, and you tell people to move away. You tell them to save their lives. At the end, this is a war, and it is a very harsh war. It is an ugly war. I have nothing good to say about any war, about the uninvolved casualties on both sides. It isn't about the numbers game of who has been killed more. We have never targeted civilians. And in any of the single occasions where we've been accused of even targeting civilians, we check ourselves from A to Z.
You're saying this is a horrible war. Some observers have described Israeli troops as exhausted, as low on munitions, and very worried about a bigger war that might break out in Lebanon. Is that what you're hearing in terms of how troops on the ground are feeling?
Yes, there's always going to be fatigue. 9 months is not just the fatigue of the soldiers. I'm a person, I'm a human being, I'm the mother of three soldiers, the wife of a soldier, I myself, all of this time, we're all in fatigue, we're all in trauma. We haven't faced what happened on October 7th, all of the above. And yes, we have to face that terror army of Hezbollah on the other side of the border in Lebanon. We have no choice.
After October 7th, there was a widespread feeling in Israel that Hamas would have to be defeated militarily. After all this time, how much has the Israeli military leadership's thinking changed in that regard, if at all?
I've never thought, and I don't think the IDF ever said, that Israel was going to destroy all of Hamas. This is about those military capabilities, so they won't be able to do an October 7th attack.
You're saying that Israel or the IDF has never said that it's going to kill every single member of Hamas, but the stated goal of this conflict is to eradicate Hamas. So where is the line? I mean, when will Israel declare victory? And why not accept a ceasefire before more people are killed on both sides if this complete eradication is not possible?
I love the question, and my heart can go out to everybody right now listening to us. I right now am inside Israel, and what you're asking me is, so what do you do against a terror organization that calls for your destruction, that attacks you the way that they did, and what's the answer to that? Do nothing? Oh, they're okay. They don't really mean it. I think on October 7th, they really meant it. Oh, you can't kill people on the other side. I never target people on the other side. Hamas are the ones who hide behind them. Hezbollah are the ones who live inside them, inside Lebanon.
We've been talking about the high death toll in Gaza. According to the Hamas-run Palestinian Health Ministry there, more than 38,000 people have been killed in this war since last October. Are Israelis worried about this rising death toll and the significant international condemnation and backlash that's come because of it?
Right now, when you're asking me about where is my heart right now, I want to mourn in my country after 9 months. I want to face the trauma that's happening here. And part of the trauma is what's happening to the younger generation of Israelis, to the fighters that have to go in to defend, and they're the ones who target. And they realize that at the end, when they've targeted the terrorists, they may have also killed innocent bystanders. We have to live with that as a country. And I very much hope that we will be able to contend with it and not us also at the same time be the ones that are turned into the pariah state of the world. It's a horrible reality for us to look at what's happened both in the United States and in Europe. And I understand that. I want to be able to go in the world and not be vilified for being an Israeli. I'm not ashamed of being Israeli. I'm not ashamed of being here. And right now I'm being shamed and vilified as the worst thing on earth. And I'm going, why don't we do that to Hamas, Hezbollah, to those who use this in such a cynical way? And I want to live here safely and defensively without non-state terror actors attacking me, and certainly without the entire international community acting as if, A, this is my fault, B, that I'm the one responsible, and that I'm the one now who needs to stop because otherwise it won't end.
Miri Eisen is a retired colonel in the Israel Defense Forces. She is also a former spokesperson for the Israeli Prime Minister's office, and she joined us from the city of Haifa. You're listening to The World.
This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. In recent months, we've been following the journey of National Geographic explorer Paul Salopek. He's been on a 24,000-mile trek across the globe on foot. It started back in 2013 in Africa's Great Rift Valley. Salopek is more than halfway through the trip that will end on the southern tip of South America in Tierra del Fuego. Of course, he's been photographing and recording the places and people he meets along the way.
Kim Kilo to the railroad?
Huh?
Kim Kilo to the railroad?
No. More than 10?
Ashraf Kilo?
Yimkin Ashra. Ashra.
That's Paul asking for directions in Jordan's Valley of the Moon. He has now completed his walk across Asia and joins us today from South Korea. Hey, Paul, how many pairs of shoes have you gone through?
Hey, Marco, you think I'd be notching my belt at this point with shoe kind of, but I honestly don't know. A couple dozen, I guess. Yeah. It depends on the quality of the shoe. They last a couple thousand kilometers or just a few hundred.
Well, today we thought we'd ask you about some of the food you have been coming across and eating on your journey. I want to start near the beginning of your walk in Ethiopia at an archaeological site called Gona. You called it the first kitchen. Why is that?
You know, this project is based on following the first humans who walked out of Africa, right? So, of course, I'm kind of looking down at my feet as I'm walking through one of our origin sites, the Rift Valley of northeastern Africa. And after talking to experts, they said the place is just littered with millions of stone tools. And what are those stone tools? They're kitchen utensils. They're choppers, they're meat cleavers, they're cutters, they're scrapers. So the African Rift, where we were born, was basically a giant cutting board, a kitchen, an antique kitchen.
And why is that important? Because it's about hominids evolving, right?
And it has a biological premise, and that is, when we were able to cut open animals for the first time millions of years ago using stone tools, we basically sliced open all this energy from the ecosystem that we couldn't get with a strictly plant diet or a mixed plant diet. So animal protein, animal fat, especially marrow, organs, they were so nutritious that they basically protonated us and allowed us to kind of evolve the way we've evolved today, big-brained apes.
So crossing Ethiopia's border into Djibouti, you wrote about a drink that's popular across Africa, palm wine. For folks who have not tasted it, how would you describe the palm wine you sampled in Djibouti?
It was kind of lemony. It was almost like a light lemonade, frothy, kind of fizzy. And it's not super alcoholic. It's actually quite nutritious. But it was kind of funny because we walked out of the desert into these palm groves. And there are a bunch of people out walking around with very large knives because they're chopping these, you know, notches in these trees to collect sap, kind of reeling in front of us, waving their rather large knives.
Now, moving along into the Palestinian West Bank in Nablus, you spent an afternoon working in a kitchen preparing Arabic dishes. What was that like?
Yeah, this is the case, you know, in a highly conflicted area where humans are at each other.
Right.
You know, and I've covered quite a few wars you have as well. Food takes on an even more heightened power when humans are in extremis. And I think it's one of the few places where there's a kind of a safe zone is the kitchen. And so in Nablus, my walking partner, Bassam Al-Mohor, and I joined a group of women who are trying to preserve Nablusi traditional cooking. As one said, everybody's eating Kentucky Fried Chicken now.
Yeah.
And they were basically trying to find these original ingredients in a culture of food in the Levant that is basically a crossroads. You know, their influences from Rome, their influences from the Ottomans.
Well, to that point, one of the Palestinian cooks told you, our history is mixed into our food.
Absolutely.
And I'm just wondering, how present was that kind of attitude when you were making food with these three Palestinian women in Nablus?
This kitchen in this ancient city that was founded by the Romans 2,000 years ago, this kitchen was an outpost of kind of cultural resistance and preservation. These women had it very conscious that the herbs they were cutting, the dough they were kneading, the dumplings they were stewing were kind of symbols of identity for them.
Wow. Now, walking across Anatolia in the eastern part of Turkey, your traveling companion, Murat, gathered food from farmers' fields. I mean, you weren't even aware he was gathering while you were hiking until the end of the day. But the photos of ripe tomatoes and berries, they're just mouthwatering. How much grazing do you do when you're traveling by foot?
Yeah, I consider it one of the fringe benefits of walking across the world on this project, Mark, is gleaning, you know, orchards. And about 80% of my route, I think it's like 15,000 miles so far, 25,000 kilometers. 80% of it is through farmland so far. Think about it, out of Africa, through the Levant into Anatolia, the Caucasus, Central Asia, it's pretty rural. So I'm eating a lot of fresh food straight out of people's fields and orchards. And my walking partner in Anatolia, a Kurdish guy, a photographer, Murat Yazar, he would empty his rucksack at the end of the day when we were making camp and outspilled this cornucopia of tomatoes and figs and fiery peppers and kind of very fresh zucchinis that snapped when you broke them. And he would just kind of smile wryly. And I'd say, where'd you get this stuff? And he'd say, in our culture, Paul, it's allowed.
One final taste from the journey, Paul, this one in eastern India in a small town called Kishanganj. There was a pizza shop there, and the owner told you how he learned to make it. Tell us the story of the pizza maker, Muhammad Afaq Qureshi.
Yeah, this is one of the more surreal food stories of this global journey. So we walk into this small town. It's mainly a Muslim town on this river in Bihar in eastern India. And I see a sign that it just pops, and it's a pizza sign. It says pizzeria, and it had an arrow. It's a handmade sign in the market. I hadn't had pizza in you know, eons. And so I followed this sign to a guy's shop. And imagine kind of an Indian busy marketplace, right, with awnings sticking out over onto streets and lots of activity, lots of local produce. And this guy had been a defense contractor in Afghanistan with the U.S. military, working for 2 years at Pizza Huts on U.S. military bases, on FOBs, forward operating bases, right?
Yeah.
Which, as you know, are like mini American cities. That's the American way of war, is you bring your Pizza Hut pizzas with you. And he had learned to make exact duplicates of Pizza Hut pizzas here in kind of the middle of India. And he was so proud of it. He had custom designed an oven. He was importing spices from a big port on the Indian coast. And I said, how's business? And he got a little bit deflated. He said, Paul, I think I'm a little bit ahead of my time. Nobody knows what pizza is here and nobody eats it.
Oh, wow. So distinct foods from disparate places along your trek. What occurs to you when you think about the common thread and the place food holds for all these people you met?
You know, every one of these people I met, every one of the kitchens I had the privilege of stepping into, the dinner tables that I sat around, whether it was a Kazakh shepherd on the floor, on a rug, on the sand, or whether it was a Saudi prince's palace with 16 courses, is that food is the common bridge to each other. No matter what culture, ideology, geography, politics, if somebody invites you to break bread, you've made it. You've made this kind of primal connection.
Mm.
And just as Murat was, you know, grazing the farmer's fields as we walked through Anatolia, internalizing his home, right? He was a melancholic Kurd, and his part of the world was in civil war for 50 years. He kind of was internalizing. He was eating his landscape, eating his home. I see this project as the same at a global level, that the planetary landscape sustains us. It's our table, and we'd better respect it. And every time we eat, We're savoring a bit of home, right? And so it's an important glue that holds humanity together.
Paul Salopek's project is the Out of Eden Walk. We'll have him back again to tell us more about the global trek. Check out the videos and stories he's been posting at outofedenwalk.nationalgeographic.org and at our website, theworld.org. Paul, thanks very much. Take care.
Thank you, Marco. Buon appetito.
Grazie mille. You're listening to The World.
It was most certainly an insane collaboration. Rappers Cypress Hill just performed at the Royal Albert Hall with the London Symphony Orchestra.
I mean, we've done concerts where crowds have gone crazy and you think, wow, but you could have powered this whole country with this sort of energy coming out of the people. I've never seen anything like it.
That's ahead on The World.
This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. With a whirlwind of talks, dinners, and press briefings, Washington hosted the NATO summit this week, marking 75 years of the alliance. For the first time, NATO leaders came out with a forceful statement aimed directly at the People's Republic of China. They also promised that Ukraine would have a pathway for joining the alliance. But overshadowing the three-day event have been questions about President Biden's health and the future role of the U.S. in NATO. The World's Europe correspondent Orla Barry has been following the latest news. So, Orla, NATO summits are known for being very carefully choreographed events. Were there any surprises or unexpected announcements that have had people talking?
Yeah, they're usually masterclasses in diplomacy, right? I think the biggest surprise of the week probably was the extent of the criticism of China by that joint statement issued by NATO leaders last night. This was Jens Stoltenberg, the Secretary General of NATO, speaking late yesterday.
China has become a decisive enabler of Russia's war against Ukraine. And China's support increases the threat Russia poses to Euro-Atlantic security.
And the official statement last night went on to say that, you know, NATO accused Beijing of sending weapons components and other technology to help the Russian military in its war in Ukraine. It said China was responsible for malicious cyber activities aimed at the US and Europe. China, as you can imagine, has dismissed the statement. Beijing's mission to the EU this morning issued a statement saying the paragraphs related to China, they said, were provocative with obvious lies and smears. And they said the NATO summit itself was filled with Cold War mentality and belligerent rhetoric.
Wow. I mean, it was a big moment for an organization focused pretty strictly on security in Europe and the North Atlantic. Was there anything else that stood out, Orla?
One other issue was there was zero mention of Israel and the war in Gaza. And I was talking to one political analyst earlier, Carlota García Encima. She's with the Elcano Royal Institute in Spain. She's in Washington at the moment. She was attending NATO events over the last 48 hours. And she said, aside from one comment by the Spanish Prime Minister, the issue of Gaza hasn't featured at all.
You have a consensus on Ukraine, but you don't have any kind of consensus about Gaza and the Middle East. The Middle East and the instability of the Middle East is increasing. They mentioned Iran, but not a word in the final communique.
Not a word about Gaza, she said. You know, there was so much talk about Russia, so much talk about the war in Ukraine, but not a single mention about the war in Gaza.
So from Ukraine's perspective, Orla, President Zelensky must have been relieved to hear assurances about NATO membership. At the same time, though, he did not get everything he wanted, right?
Yeah, no. As someone said to me earlier, what Ukraine wants will always be more than what NATO member states are prepared to give. But he has gotten some guarantees in terms of aid. They've agreed to provide more than $43 billion in the next year. Anthony Blinken, the US Secretary of State, said that F-16 jets are in the process of being transferred to Ukraine. And then, of course, there's this promise of an irreversible path, was the term they used, to NATO membership for Ukraine.
British Prime Minister Keir Starmer just came into office 6 days ago, so this was his very first NATO summit. Do we know anything about how his experience of the summit has been?
Yeah, it's been a hectic week for him. He had breakfast with Olaf Scholz, the German Chancellor, yesterday morning. He had a meeting with Volodymyr Zelensky, the Ukrainian president, in the afternoon. And then in the evening, he had to sit down with Joe Biden. But Marco, I should say, his summit was disrupted slightly because England was playing in the European Championship semi-final last night against the Netherlands. So Starmer, being a big soccer fan, as you might know, he took a short break to watch part of the match, which I'm sure he'd be glad he did because England beat the Netherlands and they're through to the finals against Spain on Sunday. But just to add to that, Starmer, not only a soccer fan, but an Arsenal fan, he presented Joe Biden with an Arsenal T-shirt then last night. On the back of the T-shirt was Biden's last name and the number 46 in reference to Biden being the 46th US president. Yeah.
Yeah, that second England goal, extraordinary. Now, speaking of President Biden, Orla, all day yesterday, there was continued speculation about whether he would continue to stand as a candidate in the November election. So to what extent was this a topic of discussion among EU leaders and others at the NATO summit?
From talking to people today, it was the topic you couldn't get away from. Most European leaders gave individual press conferences to reporters yesterday, and every single one of them that I saw was asked either, what do you think about Joe Biden and his health, or who do you think will be in the White House post-November? Their answers were all pretty diplomatic. This was Andrzej Duda, the Polish president's response.
Yesterday, I talked with President Biden, and there is no doubt that everything is okay.
observers were saying to me that what people are also talking about is what NATO will look like if Biden or indeed another Democratic candidate doesn't win in November, and whether it's possible to Trump-proof NATO, as they say. And I put this question to Raphael Loss with the European Council of Foreign Relations in Berlin earlier.
I think efforts to Trump-proof the alliance are futile given how central the United States is to the functioning of the alliance. But what allies certainly can do is to account for some of the grievances that US presidents have voiced over the past about European defense spending, about European capability to defend peace and security on their own continent.
But he said ultimately, if you have someone in the White House who's determined to undermine the alliance, there's little that other NATO allies can do about that.
NATO comes face to face with U.S. domestic politics. That's the world's Europe correspondent, Orla Barry, with a wrap-up of the NATO summit in Washington this week. Orla, thanks very much.
You're welcome, Marco.
The Darien jungle that separates Central and South America is notoriously dangerous. And still, last year, more than 500,000 migrants crossed through that border area. There are no roads in this swath of rainforest. Instead, it has been transformed into a pedestrian superhighway by people desperate to reach the United States. Now, Panama is working with the U.S. government to stop traffic along the route. Manuel Rueda has our story from Colombia, where migrants enter the jungle to cross into Panama.
Recently, a group of migrants from Venezuela and Ecuador tried to cross the Darien jungle, but they found a new obstacle on the dangerous trail that leads from Colombia to Panama, a barbed wire fence with sharp edges that's about 6 feet tall and was placed there by Panama's border police. Be quiet, says a guide. He's recording the group of about 40 people with backpacks and rubber boots as they try to get around the fence. In the video, which lasts around 12 minutes, the migrants can be seen walking through a hole in the fence, and then using a rope to get down a hill that is covered in dense tropical foliage as they try to get back to the main trail. Here's what Panama has paid for, the local guide says in the video, as he shows a broken segment of the metal fence. The U.S. has long used fences along its southern border to try to deter migrants. Panama began to do the same last week, when it began to place hundreds of meters of barbed wire along some of the remote trails that migrants are using to cross the Darien jungle. Panama's new government says it wants to reduce migration along the Darien Gap. Last week, President José Raúl Mulino said that the transit of thousands of migrants every month is putting public finances under strain and is also polluting the Darien, as migrants open trails in the rainforest and leave trash along the route.
Comprendo que hay razones profundas en la migración, pero cada país debe resolver sus problemas.
I understand there are profound reasons for migration, Mulino said in his inauguration speech. But every country has to solve its own problems. Panamanians didn't elect me to turn my back on this issue. In a statement published last week, Panama's border police said that the fences have been placed along different trails, so that migrants only use one route into Panama that leads towards a village known as Cañas Blancas. Officials say this way they can have more control over who is entering their country and provide migrants with services. But villagers on the Colombian side of the border have protested the fence, and they're suspicious about Panama's intentions. Emigdio Pertus is a spokesperson for the Colombian village of Capurganá. He's worried that more migrants will get stuck in his village. Panama isn't going to go through the trouble of closing most of the routes to just let everybody in, he says. They might impose daily quotas, or say that only those with children can go through. Pertus says that the border crossing that Panama has left open to migrants is harder to reach than those that have been fenced off. We're going to get more accidents, he says, and more injured migrants, and we don't have the capacity to treat them here. Panama has also announced it will boost patrols along sea routes and said it will put some migrants on planes back to their home countries. These removal flights will be paid for by the U.S. government under a new deal made by both nations. But experts believe that neither the border fence nor the flights will be effective. Bram Ibis is a consultant for the International Crisis Group.
Over the last few years, we've seen
so much deterrence messaging coming from different transit countries. We've seen an escalation of sexual violence, rape, brutal killings, and we've seen that nothing can deter migrants who want to leave a crisis in their home country.
Currently, there are about 1,000 migrants crossing the Darien Gap every day. So Panama and the United States would need to pay for lots of charter flights if they wanted to remove a significant percentage of people, says Tom Cartwright, an expert on deportation flights.
Probably talking between 115 and 130 people per plane, you know, if it's reasonably full. And then you have the situation of where are people going to receive them? So is Colombia going to receive Colombians back? Venezuela going to receive Venezuelans back? Will Cuba take Cubans back?
Currently, Cuba only takes one deportation flight from the U.S. per month, and Venezuela takes none, meaning that at least for migrants from those countries, the chances of getting sent back from Panama are slim. In the Colombian town of Necoclí, which is the first stop on the way to Panama, many migrants said they are still heading north, despite new obstacles. Oscar Andres Martinez, a Venezuelan construction worker, was looking for a boat that would take him toward the Darien jungle. I know of people who have been crossing, Martinez says. If one path shuts down, we'll find others. The important thing is to pursue our goal. For the World, I'm Manuel Rueda, Bogota.
And now let's catch you up on a few things you might have missed.
The president of Kenya fired nearly everyone in his cabinet today. President William Ruto says he'll form a new, leaner and more efficient government. This follows weeks of protests over high taxes and poor leadership. More than 30 people have died in the demonstrations that have since morphed into calls for Ruto to resign.
In South Korea, the military says it will start using lasers to shoot down North Korean drones by the end of this year. An unnamed defense official said that other countries are ahead of South Korea in laser weapons technology, but they use them primarily to shoot down ballistic missiles. He called using lasers against drones a game changer. Some experts question the technology.
And in Mexico, an ambitious plan to double the country's train network. President-elect Claudia Sheinbaum is talking about plans to build three new passenger train lines. They will connect Mexico's capital to cities on the U.S. border. In all, that's about 1,850 miles of passenger rail running electric trains at speeds of up to 100 miles an hour.
And that was a few things you might have missed.
Now, picture an elephant for me, if you would, but one with especially long tusks, weighing in at 100 pounds each. A group of these elephants, so-called super tuskers, roam across the border between Tanzania and Kenya. For many years, both countries banned elephant hunting in that area. But last year, Tanzania reversed the policy, and now it's considering offering hunting permits again for next year. This has triggered a feud between Tanzania and Kenya. Amy Dickman is a professor of wildlife conservation at the University of Oxford. She describes what makes these particular elephants special.
Many of your listeners would have seen of some amazing elephant, as you say, the tusks sweeping the ground in front of Kilimanjaro. So very big tusks. They tend to touch the ground often. And they're just that most iconic looking of elephants that people might think of for sort of a tourism safari.
How did this population become differentiated so that they do have these big tusks?
This sort of southern Kenya, northern Tanzania area seems to have elephants with this particular preponderance of genes that lead into having these very big tusks and animals that live long enough so that they can express those genes and actually have those full tusks grow to the, you know, to the impressive sizes that we see. You know, it's a relatively small number that have reached that large size. I've seen everything from maybe 10 to 25 animals at present that are viewed as super tuskers. Obviously, what's important to remember is that other animals coming up may become those super tuskers.
So as I mentioned, Tanzania last year allowed for hunting in the region where these super tuskers live for the first time in many years. I understand that five elephants were killed in this territory. Were any of them these last remaining super tuskers?
Some of this is way more contested than it should be. I've seen information that two of them would have classed as super tuskers, but, you know, you'd have to sort of actually look at the animals that were specifically killed. And there seems to be, because there's so much contention between the different sides on this, there seems to be a lack of willingness to share open data to identify these animals, to agree on which specific animals were killed. And I think that's something that needs to be resolved in the future if, you know, if this is actually going to come to a more amicable resolution in the future.
Yeah, let's talk about that debate right now. Tanzania is expected to announce this month whether it will once again allow hunting where these super tuskers live. How is that debate playing out? I mean, Tanzania and Kenya see this issue differently, and there are folks on both sides of the issue outside of the government also.
Definitely. So I think it's really important for your listeners to, when they're thinking about elephants, which are endangered, you know, they're endangered because largely of poaching, so illegal hunting. And this is not that kind of hunting. This is legal, regulated, limited hunting, just as happens in the US and the UK and other places. So Tanzania is another country that uses trophy hunting as a big part of its wildlife management. Kenya doesn't use it, at least of terrestrial animals. But because they've got this difference in policy, it's led to a conflict now about the fact that Tanzania, on one side of this shared elephant population, is utilizing the hunting as part of its wildlife management. And Kenya feels, for various reasons, that might be impacting the genetics of these elephants. If these are large, older males that are in breeding stage and they are those large super tuskers, they also feel it may be affecting their tourism. And obviously there is concern about whether even it's ethical to hunt very habituated animals. Tanzanian side, I think people are saying, well, in those wildlife management areas where this is happening, local people are benefiting from the revenue that comes from these hunts. And when we think about local people's relationships with elephants that we've just been talking about, it's very important to recognize that it isn't all positive. Elephants are very difficult and dangerous for local people to live alongside. So it's very important that the governments and the communities that maintain these animals do see some economic benefit from them. And so the row that we're seeing is that currently a lot of the phototourism revenue is generated in Kenya, but you're not seeing that same significance of phototourism on the Tanzanian side. They're actually trophy hunting is a bigger role in that local area for generating revenue, for enabling children to go to school, for enabling people to get jobs. And that's where it gets very interesting about whose voices you listen to here.
Amy, have you ever seen any of these super tuskers up close?
I have, yes. You know, there is something really amazing and magical about just seeing that animal that feels like it comes from a different age almost. You know, they are incredible. And that isn't to take away from the fact that I also recognize that not everyone will feel that way when they see that animal. It looks amazing when you see it from a safari vehicle. If you see it from the front of your house or when you're trying to deal with your maize crop, it can look very, very different. So I don't think we should over-romanticize them, but they are incredible animals. It's a complicated topic. And I just think that we need to go towards more dialogue, more compromise, and more listening to different perspectives on this rather than the endless pro or anti-hunting division that we tend to see in a lot of these topics.
Amy Dickman is a professor of wildlife conservation at the University of Oxford.
What do you get when you cross hip-hop legend Cypress Hill with the London Symphony Orchestra? The answer, just ahead. You're listening to The World.
This is The World. I'm Carolyn Buehler. Polling shows that Americans are becoming less religious. Church membership is falling across the country. In Maine, that's forced some churches to close. But a different trend is playing out in some of the state's African immigrant communities. Recent arrivals are helping to grow new congregations and bringing new forms of Christianity to the area. Ari Snyder from Maine Public Radio reports.
In a parking lot in downtown Portland, a cadre of Congolese and Angolan immigrants dressed in green and white uniforms is reviewing a marching formation in preparation for a parade down Congress Street. Vema Kondolu Manuel of Westbrook is leading the maneuvers.
Nous sommes aujourd'hui à Maine en train de célébrer la nativité, c'est-à-dire la naissance de Christ.
Today, he says, they're celebrating the birth of Christ. Manuel is part of Maine's small but growing Kimbangist congregation. Kimbangism is a Christian movement born in the Congo under Belgian colonial rule in the early 1900s. Its leader, Simone Kimbangu, preached black liberation and anti-colonialism and was jailed by the colonial regime for much of his life. Kimbangu's followers celebrate Christmas in May on the birthday of his son, who they view as the reincarnation of Jesus. Today's parade has drawn Kimbangists from as far away as Atlanta.
Feels great because there's all different people from our church coming from different states. We're going to be playing together, so it's fantastic.
George Mbungu of Portland is playing euphonium in the marching band. Mbungu says when his family moved to the U.S. from DR Congo, they went first to upstate New York, but relocated to Maine to join the Kimbangist church here.
I was happy because, like, I saw people that were like me, people that believed in the same religion.
The church meets in a rented hall in Westbrook, and it's part of a growing number of new congregations in the greater Portland area led by and serving African immigrant communities. It's a growth that defies national trends in organized religion. Recent polling from Gallup finds both church membership and the importance of religion in people's lives are falling to record lows. Nicolette Manglos-Weber, a professor at Boston University's School of Theology, says immigration is a major reason why those levels haven't fallen even lower, and that many traditional Christian denominations in the U.S. are taking note.
The United Methodist Church or the Episcopal Church or the Presbyterian Church are now looking towards immigrant populations to really build up and recover some of the losses.
And she says it's increasingly common to see independent African immigrant churches in the U.S., mirroring the growth of the Pentecostal movement in countries such as DR Congo and Angola. In Maine, some African immigrants are also joining long-standing Catholic, Orthodox, and Jehovah's Witness congregations. But Magali Lumiere, a Congolese interpreter who lives in Portland, says sharing a cultural connection with fellow worshipers is important to her. That led her to a Pentecostal church in Westbrook whose congregants also hail from Central Africa.
Just like that connection of where you came from, you're like, okay, we can pray in the same language.
For Lumiere, that language is often Swahili, especially, she says, if it's something really important.
I think Swahili goes straight to God.
Also in Westbrook, Sunday morning services at the City of the Lord Church have an almost concert-like feel, with a full band and live singers leading a multilingual worship. Pastor Placide Moa, originally from DR Congo, says he started the church about a decade ago when he first arrived in Maine. Back then, he says the congregation consisted of four people meeting in his house to pray. Today, he's preaching to about 100, packed into a rented American Legion hall.
Sans le Saint-Esprit,
without the Holy Spirit,
on ne peut rien faire.
We can't do anything.
La Bible dit,
the Bible says,
le jour de la Pentecôte.
Moa says his goal is to push back against declining religiosity in the U.S.
C'est qu'il y a un grand travail à faire dans ce pays.
There's a lot of work to do, he says, in this country and in this state, to bring people to Christ.
Aujourd'hui, notre culte peut-être ne sera pas très très long.
Today, though, that work may be cut short. Moa tells the congregation they have to wrap things up right on time, because another Congolese church has the space booked after them. For The World, I'm Ari Snyder, Portland, Maine.
Finally today, over the years, the animated sitcom has been prescient. It predicted the presidency of Donald Trump and the U.S. beating Sweden to win an Olympic gold medal in curling.
Let's give the Olympics a miracle.
But this time on ice.
Now, another prophecy from The Simpsons has been fulfilled. The world's Bianca Hillier has that story.
In the 1996 episode, Dad Homer Simpson tries to impress his kids by going to a music festival and hanging out with famous bands, including U.S. hip-hop legends Cypress Hill. Backstage, a crew member appears.
Hello, bands. Who is playing with the London Symphony Orchestra? Cypress Hill, I'm looking in your direction.
The band huddles before addressing the orchestra.
Do you know Insane in the Brain?
We mostly know classical, but we could give it a shot.
Last night, at the real London Symphony Orchestra, that's exactly what they did. Life imitated art when Cypress Hill took the stage at Royal Albert Hall, backed by the full orchestra.
I just cannot describe the atmosphere.
Maxine Kwok is a first violinist with the orchestra and was on stage last night.
I mean, we've done concerts where crowds have gone crazy and you think, wow, but you could have powered a small country with this sort of energy coming out of the people. I've never seen anything like it.
Unplug it, don't strain. You may hear a slight difference between last night's performance and the tracks from the 90s. Kwok says the music was rearranged to add a symphonic style without losing the original vibe.
Last night was really probably something that hadn't been heard before, because you're adding 80 or 90 musicians behind the band, punching out the rhythms and also adding a lot of huge melody and substance.
The sold-out show was one night only, but Kwok says everyone involved would love to do it again. For The World, I'm Bianca Hillier.
The World is a co-production of GBH and PRX, broadcasting weekdays from the Nan and Bill Harris studio and from the Department of Communication at UC San Diego. Find us online anytime at theworld.org. I'm Carolyn Beeler.
And I'm Marco Werman. As always, thank you for listening.